From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! California politics. Today we take a look at the most expensive non-presidential race in U.S. history, as tens of millions of dollars are poured into the race for the California governor's seat. Also, a debate on a proposition that could hobble the political power of unions, and a conversation with a teenager running for local office. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton has decided to forego a Supreme Court fight over his claim of executive privilege to prevent the testimony of two aides in a sex and cover-up probe of him. Clinton's lawyers Monday filed papers saying they won't appeal a lower court ruling that rejected Clinton's claim that executive privilege should keep his aides from testifying before Kenneth Starr. But he'll fight on another front in a lower court to keep an advisor from undergoing more questioning by the independent counsel. Clinton will argue that because of attorney-client privilege, Deputy White House Counsel Bruce Lindsay cannot be forced to testify. Monsanto has agreed to be acquired by American Home Products for more than $34 billion in stock, the largest deal ever in the pharmaceuticals industry. The combined company will be the nation's top seller of prescription drugs and a world leader in insecticides and other agricultural products. Its brands include such household names as Advil Painkiller, Centrum Vitamins, and NutraSweet Sugar Substitute. By acquiring Monsanto, American Home Products will be able to double its research spending and bolster its position in genetic engineering. The deal will also help American Home Products cover its legal liabilities over two diet drugs, one half of the combination known as Fen-Phen. This news from Geneva. Participants in a six-month global march against child labor won a standing ovation today at the annual conference of the International Labor Organization, the ILO, at the end of their six-month odyssey. Delegates stood and burst into applause as the first of 350 core marchers, those who'd taken part from the three starting points in the Philippines, South Africa, and Brazil, entered the assembly at the UN's Palais des Nations. Outside, thousands of supporters wave banners proclaiming no to child labor and calling on governments and businesses to take quick action to ban its most extreme forms, like work in mines, on construction sites, and in prostitution. Apartheid's top self-confessed assassin is being called in to bolster the case against former South African President P.W. Botha on trial for contempt after spurning the country's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Ex-Colonel Eugene de Kock is serving successive life terms of imprisonment in the country's harshest maximum security prison for death squad murders he carried out in defense of white rule. He's seeking amnesty for a host of offenses in exchange for telling the Truth and Reconciliation Commission all he knows, and has become a key witness in numerous cases in which other security officials hope to gain reprieves. Now, de Kock is expected to be called in to help the TRC seal Botha's case by testifying on his knowledge of unlawful state-sanctioned actions against anti-apartheid activists and black South Africans. Cuba's status as the black sheep of the Western Hemisphere stole the spotlight yesterday as delegates from 34 nations of the Organization of American States gathered for their 28th annual assembly. Despite U.S. pressure to keep Cuba off the agenda, the possibility of welcoming the island back into the OAS fold dominated early talks in Caracas. Cuba was excluded from the OAS, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary, in 1962 at the insistence of the United States. Many of the 34 nations have called for Cuba's re-entry into the body. India sharply stepped up spending yesterday on atomic energy and defense, 3 weeks after it shocked the world with a series of nuclear tests. The Hindu nationalist-led coalition government's maiden budget increased spending on the military by 14% over the previous year as regional tension mounted, prompted by the nuclear blasts and arch-rival Pakistan's retaliatory tests. Finance Minister Yashwant Sinha, who presented the budget for the 98-99 fiscal year from April to March, told Parliament there can be no compromise in, quote, our defense preparedness. This news from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. President Laurent Kabila yesterday reshuffled his government, sacking five ministers under investigation for alleged corruption and bringing in 13 new members, ministers who've been detained pending inquiries into the financial management of their ministries have all been fired. And from Zimbabwe, hundreds of riot police were deployed around the capital today, and the main university was closed after student protests against President Robert Mugabe yesterday. The students demonstrating were resuming a protest begun last week against alleged corruption in Mugabe's government. This news from Seattle, Washington. Bomb squads have exploded a suspicious device found outside a women's health clinic in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood. Police cordoned off about five city blocks after someone made threatening phone calls to the clinic. A suspicious cylindrical object was found outside. The building was evacuated. And that's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. With elections taking place in almost 10 states, today will be one of the busiest primary days of the year. In a test of the strength of religious conservatives, Governor Bob James Jr. of Alabama will battle serious opposition in the Republican primary. In Iowa, both parties are choosing nominees for the open governor's seat, a post that will be significant in the year 2000, given Iowa's pivotal role in the presidential primary season. Voters also go to the polls in Mississippi, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, and South Dakota. But perhaps the most high-priced, high-stakes primary is the California governor's race. In the Democratic race, the top three candidates will spend nearly $100 million in the primary alone in one of the most expensive media blitzes in election history. In fact, this race sets the all-time record for a non-presidential race. The frontrunner, Lieutenant Governor Gray Davis, has a reputation for courting Hollywood donors, crashing other politicians' events to find contributors, and for blending fundraising with his official duties. Davis is also the son of a Time Inc. executive. The Davis campaign has spent roughly $9 million, and that's the lowest amount spent by any of the frontrunners. The wealthiest of the three is multimillionaire Alfred Checkey, the former co-chair of Northwest Airlines. He alone has pumped roughly $40 million into his own campaign. That's more than any other non-presidential candidate has ever spent on a primary and general election combined. The third candidate in the Democratic race, Congressmember Jane Harman, is nicknamed B1 Jane and is well known in general for her advocacy for weapons manufacturers. Her campaign has reportedly spent nearly $20 million. In the next segment of the show, we're going to be taking on the issue of another issue in California politics, and that is Proposition 226 that deals with the issue of union dues. But right now, we're going to talk about this race. We start with Steve Scott, the political editor of the California Journal, an independently monthly covering politics and government in California. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Steve.
Good morning.
Well, why don't you lay out for us who these candidates are that are running for governor in California?
Well, I think you did a pretty good job in your opening, in your intro there. I mean, basically, we have a situation where candidates came into the race assuming that that money would talk, and it's talked, but not quite in the way that everyone thought it would. Al Checkey came in figuring that. He had the wherewithal to essentially buy the nomination, and when Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, who's one of the more well thought of politicians in the state, decided not to run for governor, in part because Checkey was standing there with this big, huge battering ram of personal wealth. Then Jane Harman came in, figuring that she would she'd cop the women's vote and cruise to the nomination because the last two gubernatorial races, California Democrats have nominated women candidates, and what happened was that the two wealthy candidates sort of canceled each other out, and Gray Davis, who raised his money in a more traditional way and has about a quarter century of experience in various aspects of state government, seems to have come to be viewed by voters as the experienced choice, and experience is what seems to be winning elections, or what seems to be the public favor right now. And so he came in as none of the above, and it looks like he's going to win the nomination.
What is this latest controversy that has arisen where Governor Pete Wilson will not accept Gray Davis's apology for accusing Wilson of bigotry and anti-Semitism?
Governor Pete Wilson looks for any opportunity to deflect criticism aimed at him for the nature of the campaigns that he's run in 1994 and 1996, both with this gubernatorial campaign and with Propositions 187 and 209. And so when Davis was giving a speech, he was sort of full of the campaign fire, and he indicated in the course of that speech that Wilson likes to fan the flames of race hatred, bigotry, and anti-Semitism. And Wilson took offense to that, and Davis clarified his statement by saying he didn't believe that Wilson was an anti-Semite, and he apologized for calling Wilson an anti-Semite. And Wilson's just trying to help Dan Lundgren, the presumptive Republican nominee, by creating a little stir with Davis and trying to accuse Davis of race baiting. It's bogus.
Yeah. Can you talk about the other candidates? In fact, because this is the first open primary, is that right? So it's not just the three Democratic candidates, also the Republicans, the Green Party, etc.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've always been on the ballot, but you had to be a Republican to vote in the Republican primary, a Democrat in the Democratic primary, et cetera, et cetera. Now every voter can vote has the opportunity to vote for every candidate, and there are actually 17 candidates for governor in California, and I'm sorry to say I'm not very well versed on most of them, but there are six of them that sort of come out as the major candidates. In addition to Harmon, Checkey, and Davis, there is also on the Democratic side. There is also on the Republican side Dan Lundgren, who's the state attorney general and who in all likelihood will be the Republican nominee. The only other Republican that's gotten any kind of statewide press attention is Dennis Perron. He is the operator of the San Francisco Cannabis Club and is involved with the provision of medicinal marijuana, and he and Lundgren have actually been at odds in court. Lundgren has taken Perron to court over his cannabis club. And then on the Green Party ticket is Dan Hamburg, who lists his ballot designation as educator, but remember a few years back in Washington, we'll remember him as having been a member of Congress from the North Coast of California. He served one term in Congress before being unseated by the man he unseated, Congressman Frank Riggs.
Well, Steve Scott, I want to thank you for that quick summary. We're going to turn to two other people to talk about the issue of money and also how the media is covering the gubernatorial race. Steve Scott, political editor of the California Journal, an independent monthly covering politics and government in California. We are also joined by Alejandro Balota, who is the state editor of the Los Angeles Spanish language daily La Opinión, and also Andy Gragis. He is the legislative director of California Public Interest Research Group, known as CalPERG. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Alejandro Balota, looking at this race from the outside, coming from outside California, one of the things I've heard about is how in this governor's race, most of what people learn about, particularly these Democratic candidates, is through their advertisements and not through media coverage, because the media and the news have hardly covered them until recently. Is that true?
Hi, Amy. Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, in what we have seen at La Opinión, we've been following new voters, specifically new voters, with our sort of focus groups. And the major candidates have been courting the Latino vote in California. Now this is a growing segment of the California's electorate, and with about 12% of the registered voters for today. Even though the Secretary of State has said yesterday that about half of the people registered to vote will be attending today. Anyways, everybody has been covering the Latino vote, or most newspapers we've read here in the area, because you cannot just set aside the Latino vote anymore. It's been become a powerhouse for every candidate and every person expecting to win a California elections.
Yesterday we had a debate on Proposition 227 in California on bilingual education, and that is going to be voted on today, a very contentious issue to say the least. And if it passes, it'll mean the end of bilingual education in California. Where do these three Democrats stand on Prop 227?
Well, the three of them are opposing mm-hmm. the 227 proposition, the initiative that will end bilingual education. And they're setting for another plan of some more gradual immersion in English. Also, the Republican candidate, that's Attorney General Dan Landgren, is opposing Proposition 227. And in this particular case, he's just putting some distance with the Wilson administration, which has the governor has is backing the initiative, and so the four of them, the four major candidates, are opposing it.
In reading some about the media coverage of the campaign, mm-hmm. I saw that La Opinion, your newspaper, co-sponsored a debate between the Democratic candidates that the English language press didn't seem to think was going to be that interesting, thinking that people were not interested in the governor's race, and found something quite different, in fact.
Well, yes. It came a debate on May the 13th, sponsored by the LA Times. Then it was for us at La Opinion, our first, this was historical for us. It was the first time the major contenders accepted to hold a debate for the Spanish media. We've been covering that with Univision and co-sponsoring by La Opinion.
And how did that debate go?
That debate went well. I mean, the four candidates were looking basically at the political center, and I should say it was very, very, very interesting. Hold on just one second.
We're talking to Alejandro Balata, who is the state editor of the Los Angeles Spanish language daily La Opinión.
Hello, Amy.
Yes.
Can you hear?
Yeah.
Yeah, for the first time, they agreed to come to us and go on a debate that was translated simultaneously in Spanish for the Spanish media and the English media as well.
Well, Andy Agregis of CalPERG, California Public Interest Research Group, you've been following the money. And in fact, CalPERG in the last election tried to get a ballot initiative passed that would limit campaign fundraising. What are your comments on this really unprecedented race? Again, this is the more money is being spent on this race than in any non-presidential race in the country, in the history of this country.
That's right, Amy. It's if for people that care about the effect of money in politics, this is a somewhat depressing election. And I thought I was glad to hear Steve mention that one of the things that's been a major issue in this race has been the independently wealthy candidates spending enormous amounts of money, led by Al Checky at they estimate $40 million he's going to go up to, which breaks records not just for a primary but for a general election. Jane Harman as well, and then the guy who's in the lead is Gray Davis, who has raised about $9 million, which would have broken records in itself. Yet he's in at number three here. But something important that Steve mentioned is that even if the front runner, even if Al Checky, who spent his own personal wealth, loses, and even if Jane Harman loses, I think it's important not to say, oh well, this shows that the voters actually reject these independently wealthy people, and it's not that big a deal to have millionaires spending their own money, because in fact it's already had its effect on the political process by shaping the choices that people have had in this election and keeping out at least two other candidates, Senator Dianne Feinstein and Leon Panetta, who chose not to be a part of the mix because of the amount of money that these rivals were able to spend, or at least in the case of Alcheky, that Alcheky was able to spend.
Andy Agrejas, we have to break. I want to thank Alejandro Balata for joining us from the Spanish-language daily La Opinión in Los Angeles. And Andy Agrejas, I'd like to ask you to stay on the phone so that we can talk about campaign fundraising and what it is that you are proposing for this kind of spending of private money to stop. Then we're going to look at a debate on union dues and how they're used in California, another proposition that's being considered. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue in our discussion in an unprecedented race that's going on in California, a high-priced, high-stakes primary where the top three candidates, Democratic candidates, will be spending nearly $100 million in the primary alone, one of the most expensive media blitzes in election history. Our guest, Andy Agrejas, a legislative director of the California Public Interest Research Group. Now, most of this $100 million is being spent on television. Is that right?
That's right.
It seems that then there's an added incentive for television stations not to cover these races because they just get more money for advertisements then, if that's how people are going to learn about the candidates.
That's right. This election, there's been some very good coverage of that in the newspaper, I thought, with some journalists traveling the road saying, you know, they were in Los Angeles at the time of the gubernatorial debates, and that you couldn't find it on a single television station in the 6 o'clock news. It's that kind of problem that if at one point, you know, candidates say, we need to raise this kind of money so we can be heard because the media doesn't cover campaigns anymore, there's at least some truth to that. The press doesn't, at least the television where most people get their news, hasn't been covering the race with any real amount of attention, and it's really just been about raising money for these ads that have been bombarded with. The ad season here started earlier than ever in November with Alcheky doing a set of commercials with children trying to pronounce his name as a way of softening him up for voters. That worked for a while, and then he...
Well, Checky sounds pretty clear. What's going on there?
That's what I've had a name that's hard to pronounce, so I was surprised by that. But
now, his money comes from Northwest Airlines. He's former co-chair.
That's right.
Jane Harman, go ahead.
He was one of the folks who took over Northwest Airlines, I guess, in the late 80s, and there's a lot of controversy as to whether they turned it around and made it profitable or whether he and his partners took it, and because of the debt that they loaded onto it, then had caused the crisis that they then had to bail it out of. But he has his fortune from Northwest Airlines. Its stock soared. Was worth an estimated $500 million and has been able to pump this amount of money into his own campaign.
Congressmember Harman's money?
Congressmember Harman's money comes from primarily her husband and the family fortune. Her husband, Sidney Harman, of an electronics firm that makes stereo equipment. Mostly from that source, although she has also raised substantial amounts from the defense industry, which is really, there's tons of defense industry manufacturers in her district in the Palos Verdes area in California. Some of the biggest folks, Northrop Grumman and Hughes Aircraft and all those folks, have contributed a sizable amount. But the bulk of her money comes from her own private fortune.
And Lieutenant Governor Gray Davis has raised his money from?
He's raised his money from a variety of sources. He's got the support of the unions, and people think he's actually been helped by the anti-226 campaign because the labor movement is doing get out the vote and phone calls for him. But he's also raised lots of money from wealthy individuals. In looking at the late contributions to Gray Davis, he got a $25,000 contribution from Bernie Allegan, who's the CEO of Packard Bell, $25,000 contribution from the Pacific Capital Group, $25,000 from one Indian tribe that is involved in the Indian gaming issue, $10,000 from the CEO of Clifford Electronics. So this kind of large, wealthy contributions that the average person can't afford are also a big part of his campaign.
Andy Agrejus, the campaign finance debate is also resuming in Washington in the House this week, with GOP leaders expected to try to kill reform legislation. Can you tell us in a minute, before we move on to the union proposition debate, the proposition over union dues, can you tell us what you're suggesting needs to be done to change what's happening in California and around the country?
Well, the bill in Congress, the Shazamian bill, is good, although modest in its effect. It would deal with the issue of soft money being raised by the parties and the difference in and tighten the distinction of what is an issue ad that has to disclose its sources of funding and what's an independent expenditure that an issue ad that doesn't right now have to disclose its sources of funding and independent expenditure that does. But that wouldn't really have an effect on California. The kind of reform that you would need to have an effect on California is pretty comprehensive reform that the Supreme Court has in the past said you really can't have, and it's something we need to keep plugging away at, which is spending limits that cap how much wealthy individuals can spend on their own campaigns, because it's very important that people who just have lots of money can't distort the political process in this way. And then also the ability to have very low contribution limits that would allow force candidates to raise their money in small amounts that the average person could afford. And unfortunately, we've had judges not just throwing out spending limits in cases around the country, we've had them throwing out low contribution limits as well. And both of those things would really be necessary to equalize people's impact on the political process. And there's other things that they could do in combination with those things, such as providing candidates with a clean money option, having public funds for candidates that qualify and agree not to raise private money to fund their campaigns. So those kinds of things, the combination of those things, but definitely starting with, I think, limiting the amount of money that wealthy people can spend on their own campaign and having low contribution limits that equalize people's ability to impact the political process is the kind of reform we need. And we're just going to have to keep pushing it until the Supreme Court changes its mind.
Well, Andy Agrejus, I want to thank you for joining us. If people want to get in touch with California Public Interest Research Group, CalPIRG, where can they call?
916-448-4516.
One more time, a little slower.
Oh, it's 916-448-4516.
And I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue with this look at California politics today, a day which is a primary day and a day people are going out and voting on ballot initiatives in a number of states, in 10 states. We're going to turn now to another issue being taken up. Yesterday on Democracy Now! We featured a debate on one of two referenda that California voters will weigh in on that could have national consequences, Proposition 227, which would abolish bilingual education programs. Today, we'll have a debate on Proposition 226, which, if passed, would force labor unions to get permission from individual members before spending their dues on political campaigns, a move that both sides agree could be repeated in other states if California takes the lead. Supporters of 226 say this will hobble what they depict as corrupt union bosses they say are unwittingly financed by workers. But opponents say it's simply a big business ploy to crush the political power of unions. We're joined right now by two people. Judith Barish is Communications Director of the California Labor Federation, the California AFL-CIO, representing California's 2,000 unions and 2 million union members. And Jim Reigheimer, co-author of Proposition 226, the initiative that would require unions to obtain written consent of their members before using union dues for political purposes. He's founder and director of the California Foundation for Campaign Reform and Tests in California. Let's begin with you, Jim Reigheimer. Can you tell us what is exactly Proposition 226?
Yeah. Proposition 226 is a pretty simple proposition. It basically says that any corporation or a union must get permission from an employee annually before they take any money out of their paycheck or union dues, which can be used for political purposes, meaning money that's given to candidates or initiatives here in California. It's a statewide initiative. It only affects statewide candidates. It wouldn't affect anything for, like, Congress or your U.S. Senate. And it's a very simple initiative, obviously. The kind of dollars that have been spent against it right now, people don't know what it is out there in California, but if they read their ballot pamphlet, it's pretty clear what it is.
Judith Barish, what is your problem with this?
Well, we don't think it's particularly simple at all, and we don't think the initiative is about union dues. The initiative is brought to you by people who want to shift the political balance of power in California. They know that corporations already outspend unions 11 to 1 in politics. That's not enough for them. They want to make it 11 to 0. And this is about imposing extremely cumbersome bureaucratic regulations on unions to silence the political voice of working families.
And how exactly would it work? What would it mean for union members?
For union members, it's a process of filling out annual paperwork that then has to be submitted to both union and employer. For employers, unions, and any other organization that does dues deduction, including your charity that you contribute to through United Way or your health insurance, it involves an extremely elaborate record-keeping process with the possibility of fines and punishment if records aren't perfectly kept and if money is spent that isn't accounted for. I mean, it's ironic that this initiative is brought to you by people who say they want to get government interference out of people's lives, because it's an extremely intrusive bureaucratic regulation into independent organizations.
Mm-hmm. How do you justify that intervention, Jim Rickheimer?
Well, I mean, basically, I've been doing this this campaign there for about a year and a half, and it's absolutely amazing how the labor bosses in California have no problem with just lying directly to people here in California. There's nothing in this initiative that has anything to do with charitable contributions whatsoever. Judith Barish knows that. She also knows that the United Way came out because the unions tried to force them into this issue and made a statement on May 13th that said that 226 does not in any way affect the United Way. It only affects political contributions and not charitable contributions. But she'll continue to say that, and she'll continue to lie because, quite frankly, these people have no shame whatsoever.
Well,
they cannot argue this issue on the merits. They haven't argued this issue on the merits. We have now been outspent on this issue over 10 to 1. They've spent $25 million, every dollar of which has been taken out of somebody's paycheck without their permission to fight this initiative. And I think here in California, when people walk into the ballot today, they're going to read it. It's going to be right in front of them. It's going to simply say, before someone takes the money out of someone's paycheck for politics, they get their permission. And that's all this initiative is.
Judith Barish of
Just want to say on this issue of charitable contributions, because this is a contentious issue, as far as we understand it, this initiative would apply its same bureaucratic regulations to any organization that does any sort of deduction from your paycheck. And the legislative analyst of California, who's a nonpartisan position, the state controller, the Senate Office of Research, the California Association of Nonprofits, and many attorneys, including some of the largest management side attorneys in the state, all agree that it's likely to apply to charitable contributions as well. And we think that's a real concern. I mean, nonprofits in California and environmentalists, for example, are extremely anxious that their flow of funding could be cut off by this initiative.
Well, I mean, again, here we go. We use the weasel words. We might, could, we're not really sure. You know, when we wrote this initiative, it was very clear to us to make sure that it did not affect groups like the United Way, because we actually said, you know what, who else takes deductions out of checks? You know, charities take deductions out of checks. So we worked with the lawyers here in California who work with the Political Reform Act. I talked to the American Cancer Society. I asked them, which law firm did you use to look into this? They said, well, we used a law firm here in New York City. And I said, well, the law firm in New York City doesn't have any clue about what the California Reform Act is. The bottom line is, and these groups that are all out there saying that there's some issue out there, never contacted Proposition 226, did not hire any lawyers that handle political reform here in California. But again, they really don't care, because all they care about is trying to confuse the people here in California. because they know that when it comes to initiatives, all you have to do is confuse people, and people will say, well, you know what, maybe we'll leave it the status quo, we're not going to change it. These people have no shame, they will lie, they will drag down United Way, they will drag down any other charity they can because they really don't care. They cannot argue this issue on the simple fact that says, before money is taken out of a person's paycheck and spent on politics, you get their permission. That's all this initiative does.
Well, I don't know if you want to impugn the motives of the California Heart Association, the Lung Association, the Cancer Association, the Association of Nonprofits, and all of these organizations that, with no tie whatsoever to the union bosses that you're trying to smear, have evinced real concern that the initiative will cut off some of their funding sources.
But we can talk
about the motives of other folks as well, of the people who are behind this initiative. I mean, Mr. Righeimer, you and your buddies in Orange County are pursuing a political vendetta against unions. You've been trying to get prayer in schools and school vouchers, eliminating school counseling programs, eliminating school breakfast programs. You team up with right-winger, out-of-state extremists like Grover Norquist and J. Patrick Rooney, who want to privatize Medicare and Social Security. People like Grover Norquist are on record saying they want to crush unions, and initiatives, policies like Prop 226 are the perfect vehicle. And then we have organizations like the California Restaurant Association who say they're giving $250,000 to the Yes on 226 campaign, not because they're concerned about workers' rights, but because unions want to increase the minimum wage and save daily overtime for workers. We know what the agenda is. It's perfectly clear. It's about silencing the political voice of working families.
Jim Righeimer.
Well, I mean, basically, if they continue to go down the road of not talking about what the issue is, they'll continue not talk about what the issue is. There is no doubt about it that there is a diversity in California what people think should happen politically in this state. And there's no doubt about that. Nobody's going to say there isn't. But again, you'll make character assassinations. You'll attack people. You'll do anything else except talk about the issue. I've been on debates. I don't know how many hundreds of debates I've done here. I have never had a person from the other side, any of the union people on the other side, just flat out say what they want. The bottom line is they're afraid that they're going to lose power. That's all it comes down to. If they would just say, we're afraid we're going to lose power, then at least we can have an honest discussion about it over there.
What about
all,
this?
All we're saying is that when you take money out of a person's paycheck without their permission, it is wrong. I knew that when $25 million was spent against an initiative, they could make black look like white and white look like black, and that's all they really care about out there.
Judith
they
Barish.
They will not discuss this issue. They
just one second, Jim. Judith Barish, you just talked about school vouchers. Maybe you could give people, particularly outside of California, a little background there about a school voucher proposal that was offered that the teachers' union fought against. That seems to be the beginning of Proposition 226.
Wait a second. Hold it. Let me just do it. That is not the beginning of what this proposition is about. This proposition was simply about, if you want to know where it all started from, it started from local school boards here in California, where I was sitting there working with local teachers on their local school boards. They were furious because money was coming out of their check to support candidates while they're stuffing envelopes for another candidate. And they said,
Mr. Righeimer, you and your friends were furious because you lost some political battles with the teachers' union on the other side, and you were on record, I don't know about you personally, but you and some of the other authors of the initiative were on record saying that you lost because of union spending. And
this initiative is
clearly a political vendetta against labor unions.
Well, that's a nice twist to how you want to put it over there. A lot of issues start out of people because they look at situations that are frustrated. This was started, no doubt about it, because of education here in California, which we think is very important. It started because local teachers wanted to get people elected to local school boards and their local unions and the National Education Association and the California Teachers Association, who right now have put $8, $9 million into this campaign, took money and got involved in local school board races against the candidates the teachers themselves wanted to put into office, and at the time were taking money out of the teachers' paychecks to support those candidates.
We got to clear up one thing here, because you say that I don't want to talk about the issue. So let's talk about this particular issue of taking money out of people's paychecks.
Please.
Unions are democratic membership organizations, and all decisions about how money is spent, how it's collected, where it goes, are made either through majority votes or through decisions made by a majority of elected representatives, which all union members can vote for. Now, admittedly, sometimes it hurts, as with your friends in Orange County, to be on the side of the minority. And for those union members who are on the side of the minority in a particular decision that their union takes, such as about political spending, I encourage them to get involved, to participate in local union meetings, to vote out their leaders if they want to. But to ask for government regulation that steps in, overrules the democratic process of their union, overrules their capacity to participate and decide how their money is spent, I think that's completely illegitimate outside interference in the activity of a democratic membership organization.
Jim Righeimer, I'll let you respond in a minute, but stations have to identify themselves. We're talking to Judith Barish, Communications Director of the California Labor Federation, and Jim Righeimer, co-author of Proposition 226, the initiative that would require unions to obtain written consent of their members before using union dues for political purposes. And that issue is on the ballot today in California. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with them in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our two guests, Judith Barish, Communication Director of the California Labor Federation, and Jim Righeimer, co-author of Proposition 226, the initiative that we are debating right now that would require unions to obtain written consent of their members before using union dues for political purposes. Judith Barish just said that this is government interference in a democratic independent organization like unions. Jim Righeimer, your response.
Well, let's look at the organization. There's two major points on that. Number one, unlike any other organization out there, whether it's any kind of association, trade association, environmental group or whatever, you have to belong to the union in most cases to keep your job. It's not some organization you joined voluntarily completely. You join it because you have to, number one. Number two, just because in order to keep your job you have to belong to the union does not mean you have to check your First Amendment rights at the door. The problem that we have here in unions is that they take money out of a person's paycheck to go ahead and do the political will that the union bosses would like them to do in there. Now, people talk about this democracy out there, and I think we have to be completely honest about this and talk about the kind of organizations we're talking about here. The AFL-CIO, of which I'm talking to someone right now on who worked for that organization over there, had their political director indicted 3.5 weeks ago because he laundered $1.2 million of union dues into political campaigns.
Well, the AFL-CIO is not a union. We're a union of unions. And
okay,
there's an important distinction there, Jim.
Okay, a distinction there. And you take money from people at lower levels because those unions belong to a union. But they're an umbrella organization. Fine. Let's look at the Teamsters Association.
Hang on
there.
One. Let's step back.
No, I don't want to step back.
We're
going to talk about democratic organizations here.
Well, let me give you a chance to answer your arguments. I mean, you said that you have to belong to unions.
Hold on. I never interrupted you. The Teamsters Association over there, right now, last year, the taxpayers in the United States paid $26 million to run what was considered to be a proper election because they felt the Teamsters couldn't run a non-corrupt election. 3 months later, the U.S. government throws out the election because the Teamsters, after spending $26 million, ran a corrupt election over there. These are the kind of organizations that talk about saying that they're very democratic processes. I just did a rally yesterday here in Orange County where, I mean, they send thugs in. Screaming, yelling, kicking down doors and everything else at a rally.
Jim Righeimer, let's let Judith Barish respond because we only have a minute.
Go ahead.
You're concerned that unions aren't democratic membership organizations. And I tell you, as you know perfectly well, that members of unions have more democratic protections than the members of any other organizations. You say you don't have to be a member of it, you have to be a member of a union if you work somewhere, but as you know perfectly well, union members have the legal right to opt out of paying the political portion of their dues if they want to. In other words, not only do union members get to vote on how their money is spent, on who their leadership is, and so on, but if they are in the minority on a position, if they lose the vote, they have the right to opt out of that portion of their membership and that portion of their membership dues that goes for political financing. Now, this goes way beyond the rights that any of us have, say, as members of the state of California. In California, if I don't like who we voted for governor, that does not give me the right to opt out of paying a portion of my taxes. And yet this right, the right of dissenters, is guaranteed for union members. What you want to do, though, has nothing whatsoever to do with union members' rights or workers' rights. It's about shifting the political balance of power in California by silencing the only group in the state, the only institutionalized interest that speaks out for working people, their wages, their working conditions, and their life on the job.
You know, it's interesting. I just want to point out there was a piece in the New York Times, a letter to the editor from Marvin Krasnansky in Sonoma, California, that was talking about the Times' editorial treating shareholders like workers. It says, you correctly note the inequity of California's Proposition 226. While unions would be required to obtain annual advance approval from members for political contributions, no such requirement is imposed on corporations. As a retired corporate executive, he writes, with responsibility for company-sponsored political action committees, I would also note that corporations spend considerable amounts of shareholder money, including high-priced executive talent, to organize and promote PACs. Any legislation should also apply to such expenditures. What do you think of that, Jim Rickheimer?
Well, let's go back to the first issue first, and I'll answer that issue. Number one, what no one ever talks about the union, because they try to get around this, is they say it's optional. You can opt out. You don't have to pay this part. What they do not tell you is in order to opt out of most unions in California, you have to resign from the union.
And then
when you resign from that union, you still have to pay everything but the political portion of it. You still have to pay all your dues, everything else that the union takes out of it. But now you can no longer vote on your contract, you can no longer vote on your membership, and you can no longer get any of the benefits of the union over there just because the small portion of those dues, which goes towards politics, which you may disagree with, you don't want to pay that. So they'll always say you can opt out, but they're basically saying you have to quit the union. And it's a nice way for them to cleanse the opposition in the union. Basically, they get rid of all the dissenters, number one. Number two, on the issue with regards to corporations, there's a massive distinction there. One organization, unions, takes money out of working people's paychecks. And we think that's absolutely wrong if you don't have their permission over there. When you buy a stock in a company, you choose to buy that stock. You write that check to your broker to buy that stock. That's the company that you want to own stock in over there. If you don't want to own stock in that company, you can sell the stock in that company. And there's a lot of people that have moral or political differences with corporations and simply won't buy their stock, whether it be tobacco, cigarettes.
But you can't change their policy. You simply have to sell it.
Yeah, you simply have to sell it. And the big distinction that we see here is, number one, if I work in California, the company requires me to belong to a union, I have to join the union, and then they take money out of my check for political purposes over here. That's a choice that I do not have, and dollars come out of my check. To buy a stock, and it's the analogy they continue to try to make out there, is if there has to be something, there's some nexus there. There is no nexus there. If you don't want to have money come out of, be spent out of stock for politics, don't buy that stock in that corporation.
Well, Jim Rickheimer, I gave you the first word. Judith Barish, I give you the last word.
Well, I think Mr. Rickheimer has given a beautiful contradiction here, which is saying on the one hand that you have to be a member of a union, and on the other hand that if you don't want to spend your money on political purposes in the union, you have to resign the union. Therefore, you don't have to be a member of a union. As we said before, we're talking about democratic membership organizations that decide through majority votes who leads them and how their money is spent. That's what a union is. If people want dissent from this, they can decide through the internal democratic processes of their own union to do something else. What we don't need is a new act of big government interference into organizations that will single out unions, leave corporations and other special interests untouched, and silence the political voice of working families. That's the agenda behind the backers of Prop 226. And that's why we're urging people to vote no on Prop 226.
Well, on that note, we do have to wrap up this discussion. It's going to be a very close race on this issue, the ballot 226, Proposition 226. We will continue to follow it and report back tomorrow on what happens. Judith Barish, Communication Director of the California Labor Federation, the California AFL-CIO, representing California's 2,000 unions, 2 million union members. Jim Rickheimer, co-author author of Proposition 226, the initiative that would require unions to obtain written consent of their members before using union dues for political purposes. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and as we wrap up today's show, we're going to turn to someone else in California. We've talked about the millionaires running for the governor's seat in the California primaries. Now we're going to turn to a smaller local election in Nevada City that could signal a departure from politics as usual. At 19, Rainy Blue Clouds Greensfelder is one of the youngest candidates to run for office in California. She's running for a seat in the city council. She's a member of the punk rock band Sentiment, but despite her youth, Rainy Blue Cloud has a long and impressive history of community activism. When she was 12, she organized a protest march against the Persian Gulf War at her school. She started a Food Not Bombs program in Nevada City, which aids indigent and homeless people, and fought against public conduct ordinance, which would target young people congregating at street corners and sidewalks. She's running on a platform that includes advocacy for the arts, the environment, and civil rights. Rainy Blue Cloud, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Why did you decide to run for city council?
Well, I've been working in the community for about 4 years now, really intensely involved. And I've reached a point where I don't feel like I can get much done with the present city council. It's been really frustrating to me to have these great ideas and have these great issues I'm working on and have them turned away blindly by the city council. So I feel we need more ears in the city.
Well, it's interesting. You've proved you can play real politics as well. You've raised more money than any other candidate in Nevada City history. How have you done this?
Well, you know, I think I need more exposure than your average candidate because people, they don't want to hear what I have to say at first when they see me because I look a little different.
What do you mean you look different?
Well, I've got purple hair and it's in a mohawk and I have facial piercings and you know, I my clothes are not average. I wear combat boots, and you know, my clothing is my art. So I don't look like your average candidate. And people have seen past my appearance, and those who really support me have been sending me money, and I've been able to put up lawn signs and send out mailers. So I think I need to raise more money than the average candidate in Nevada City.
Can you talk specifically about what you would do as a city council member?
My first order of business would probably be to work for a community center here. We've been really lacking in a community center. We need a place for nonprofit organizations to work, and we need a place for young people to go. And I thought it would be nice if we got the young people and the senior citizens together in one place, and they could meet each other and they could learn how to coexist again, because what's really lost in this town, that intergenerational communication. And it also make better decisions on environmental issues here, because I feel like the environment has been ignored in the last few years in this town. And there's been some really devastating decisions made here.
Tell us more about the public conduct ordinance.
The public conduct ordinance was voted in last summer by the city council. It would make it illegal to sit on the sidewalk, to sit on the curb, to lay on a park bench, or to stand on any sidewalk in such a way that a police officer thought that you were blocking the sidewalk. Now, they tell us this won't be selectively enforced, but we can't foresee an officer asking a tourist window shopping to move while a young person would be standing in the exact same way, and I'm sure that they would be harassed by the police force. So we feel it's an unconstitutional ordinance, and it would be selectively enforced, and we've been fighting very hard for over a year to stop it.
Rainy Blue Cloud, what would you say to those who say you need more experience before you run for public office? You're 19 years old.
Well, I've had a few years' experience in this town. I've worked really closely with politics in this town for the last 4 years. And who says that you need every bit of experience to be a part of the political process? I think we need all ages and all people of all walks of life involved in city politics. And especially in such a small town where, you know, there's really a large cross-section of people here and half of them are not being represented by the current council. So my history behind me, there needs to be didn't see different people on the city council.
How are you running your campaign? I mean, are you running TV ads? Do you have a large group of campaign volunteers? Are you going out and speaking at rallies?
I have a great campaign manager. His name is Brian Vincent, and he works with the Western Ancient Forest Campaign. He's done a great job organizing volunteers for me, and I've been going door to door as much as I can. I have huge holes in my combat boots. And I've been doing debates with the other candidates and interviews with local papers and radio stations.
And on what points do you differ with them most?
Mostly on Measure C, I'd have to say.
Which is?
The public conduct ordinance. Mm-hmm. Three out of the other four agree with me on that one, but the fourth, the current mayor, is very supportive of Measure C. But I think it's more the larger issues that I disagree with them on, because I think we can all agree here that this is a small town. We need to protect the small town atmosphere we have here and keep large business out and large corporations out.
You mentioned that your campaign manager is an organizer for Western Ancient Forest Campaign. How does that play into your campaign?
Well, he's just somebody I've met in this town through our activism. And since we have such close views on a lot of issues, he was willing to work on my campaign. And he's worked on some congressional campaigns.
But what does it mean in terms of your stand on the environment? How is that issue play out?
Well, you know, there's not a whole lot of environmental issues in this area, but the gold rush, when the gold rush came through here, it just devastated everything, devastated the entire town. And, you know, now we have these trees that are just beginning to get old and beautiful, and people are wanting to cut them down because they feel they're a hazard. And people like Brian and myself are doing everything we can to protect the creeks and the trees and the animals in the area.
Well, I want to thank you, Rainy Blue Cloud Greensfelder, for joining us. And we'll let our listeners know what happens today. Have you taken any polls?
Not yet. No, we'll be having a big campaign party tonight and watching the results come in.
Rainy Blue Cloud Greensfelder is running for city council in Nevada City, California.
Thanks.
And thank you very much for being with us. And that wraps up today's coverage of California politics. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's to order a cassette copy from the Pacifica Archives, 1-800-735-0230. And special thanks to Pacifica stations KPFA and KPFK, A in Berkeley and K in Los Angeles, their newsrooms, for helping out with today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hee-Soo Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Many thanks to Bill O'Neill, who engineered our show today from WNYC, while Pacifica station WBAI makes its historic move to Wall Street. Earl Maitland's our technical director, Michelle Garcia, our webmeister, Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman, and thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!